Just recently, I learned that newspaper and magazine writers are increasingly being paid a small amount for their writing. And the reason for this is because the bulk of their income is then coming from how many clicks their article gets on the publication website. So, if you're a writer, your financial well-being is dependent on how many people choose to read your article. Here's the thing. Most websites only give you a headline with which to encourage your potential reader to click your link. As a result, can you guess what most publications choose to use as headlines? Yep, you've got it. Rage. Headlines that irritate us or divide us or anger us or incense us, those are the headlines that earn the most. Outrage gets clicks. Now, I think part of the reason that we are drawn in by anger is that there's something elemental to it, something that resonates deep within us as if it's part of our wiring. From ancient times across cultures, traditions, and beliefs, anger and rage have drawn the interest of humans. Take, for example, the Genesis narrative of Cain and Abel. Now, this story is the earliest relational story in the tradition of the three major world religions, so Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And yet this story, one of the earliest surviving stories about humans, is a narrative of an enraged man called Cain who murders his brother Abel. Like, anger is the emotion of the first human relational story in Scripture. But what about even to this day? Anger still interests us. Take, for example, the last few decades of Marvel movies. The one superhero from that group that has an emotional connection to his superpower is the Hulk, this giant green lump of rage. And while his alter ego is always saying, "Well, you won't like me when I'm angry," the near $500 million that Hulk films grossed at the box office suggests that that might not be true. We do like Hulk angry. And right, I realize that Hulk doesn't really live out the verse that we discussed in our last video from James 1 and verse 19. Like, every person should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. But does the Hulk perhaps give us something of an insight into how we perceive anger in popular culture? The basic plotline of the Hulk franchise is counter to the ordinary superhero narrative, where the hero is consistently urged to use their superpower, whereas the Hulk spends most of his story arc trying to avoid activating the destructive rage within him. So, at some level, I wonder, does Hulk represent all of us in the contemporary world? For many of us, the only guidance we've ever been given on anger is, don't be angry. So, at some level, all of our lives are mini Hulk stories. We navigate the world constantly fighting the urge to rage. And not dissimilar to Hulk, eventually, with the right set of circumstances, the rage comes out. And of course, as we know from watching the movies, once Bruce Banner lets go, there's just no going back. It's interesting to me, though, that James 1 and verse 19 is actually more nuanced than what we learn about rage from, well, the Hulk or our society generally. I don't know if you noticed this or not, but what does James actually say about anger? He says every person should be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. Do you notice that he doesn't say what we might expect the Bible to say and what we're always told? He doesn't say, don't be angry. Rather, the biblical advice is, don't get angry quickly. However, that's not actually the end of James's thought. The idea that he's expressing actually comes to an end in verse 20. And so the whole package of verse 19 and 20 reads like this. Every person should be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. Human anger, you see, doesn't produce God's justice. Now, God's justice is a phrase that the Bible writers use to describe how God's going to put the world right. Sometimes you'll hear the term referred to as God's righteousness, but it's how God's going to fix things. So notice, the critique of anger from a biblical basis isn't simply don't be angry, but rather it's rooted in the knowledge that anger doesn't fix things. The content of our anger doesn't actually solve anything, which perhaps leads us to ask a different question. So my aim throughout this Age of Rage series isn't to end up with a sort of Holy Hulk situation where we simply approve of and sanctify repressing our feelings. I think the current behavior of Jesus followers around the world gives us some evidence that we've got as many anger issues as the next person, if not more. So I think we need something a little more than simply don't be angry. Rather, I want to scratch at James's problem with anger. The question essentially being, what does it achieve? Now, to understand what our anger is achieving, I think there might be a different question to ask. Specifically, the question, why? Why are you angry? Why do I feel that particular way about this particular thing? What is my anger telling me about myself? Or let's ask ourselves this question. Have you taken time to ask what your relationship is to your anger? Like, what do I actually have to be legitimately angry about? I'm a comfortable white man who lives in North America. In terms of global history, I'm near the top in terms of comfort and safety, and even that's true during a pandemic. And yet I find so much to be angry about. Like, some of my anger might just sneak into the category of righteous anger, the state of politics or global economics or social injustices. But if I'm more transparent, too much of my own anger finds its location in driving offenses or behavior in the grocery store, that I think I have to honestly ask whether the majority of my anger simply relates to just not getting things the way I'd like them, just not getting my own way. So what exactly is anger? The neuroscientist Dean Burnett describes anger this way: a state of emotional and physiological arousal typically experienced when some sort of boundary is violated. Now, just listen to that again. A state of emotional and physiological arousal typically experienced when some sort of boundary is violated. So anger is about boundaries. Boundaries that we hold important that are then crossed by someone else. It doesn't really matter who you are, white Scotsman or Indigenous Canadian, you will have boundaries that you don't like being threatened. So, for example, someone borrows money from you and they don't pay it back soon enough or at all. Well, then your financial or your security boundary has been crossed. Or someone says something that you find offensive. Well, then your moral and ethical boundary is violated. If it later turned out that this person did that thing intentionally, then your social and relational boundaries are broken. Now, at an organic level, what's probably going on here is some sort of survival mechanism. In the strictest neurological sense, anger is a response to a perceived threat, an emotion that our ancestors probably used to stay alive in the face of, you know, attackers with their club or, you know, a predator with big teeth. In the modern world, however, this threat response is now being used to navigate, you know, internet trolls and people who steal our parking spot at the mall. Like, we might not be in physical danger, the same sort of danger our predecessors were in, but our reputation or our social standing being threatened often produces the same result: rage. So let's take this notion of anger as boundary violation and add it to the human experience. And it instantly becomes more complex because humans, well, we don't operate as individuals. No, humans are tribal. We like being in groups, and particularly, we like being in groups that have shared morals and values. This gives us a sense of belonging and security. However, the psychology of groups is such that they generally work to strengthen and affirm our shared boundaries. This is what Jonathan Haidt calls our moral matrix, where once we find our group, we find ourselves increasingly divided against other groups. We become more entrenched in our thinking and more likely to be blinded to anything that might threaten our boundaries and our perspectives. In this type of situation, if you can try to imagine it, our perspective on the world ends up being divided into those who are for and those who are against. And when those who are against do anything that threatens those who are for, it's eventually a recipe for, yep, you guessed it, outrage. So is the anger in the world today being driven by the increasing wall being constructed between us and those we disagree with? Are we becoming more boundary sensitive than ever before? Have we taken our ability to listen to different perspectives and traded it for Border Patrol, who ensure that our boundaries are not crossed? Like, we live in a world where online algorithms enforce our confirmation bias to the extent that we rarely encounter ideas we disagree with. Meaning that when we do bump into something new, a different idea, it seems more shocking, more infuriating, more enraging, and more likely to entrench us in our tribe. Like, for example, if you consume news from an exclusive source, it's an almost certainty that you are being shaped to view those of a different political bias negatively. Like, is it really possible that we could change our perspective on other humans and decrease our rage towards them, simply by occasionally watching a different news outlet? There's this scene in the book of Joshua where he encounters a messenger from God. In chapter 5, Joshua opens with a question pulled right out of the 21st century. Joshua says to this messenger, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" Essentially, Joshua asks, "Whose side are you on?" To which the man replies, "Neither." Quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. In the year 522 BCE, the prophet Daniel was in captivity in Babylon, where he was tasked with serving the pagan king Darius I of Persia. It was roundly understood by the Jews that they were in this exile because of their rank and file disregarding of the way that God had advised them to live. But in Daniel chapter 9, there's this prayer recorded by Daniel. Daniel, who has carefully, cleverly, and cunningly lived out his loyalty to God while serving a foreign king and nation. The text of his prayer reads like this. "I prayed to the Lord my God and confessed, 'Lord, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keeps his commandments. We have sinned and done wrong. We have been wicked and have rebelled. We have turned away from your commands and laws. We have not listened to your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name. We have sinned against you. The Lord our God is merciful and forgiving, even though we have rebelled against him.'" Now, at first glance, this isn't an overly remarkable prayer of confession, the sort of thing that you kind of regularly encounter in religious life. We have sinned, we have rebelled, we've not listened, we've done wrong, we've been wicked, we have transgressed, we've turned away, we have been unfaithful, we've refused to obey. I mean, it's pretty standard stuff, right? But here's the remarkable bit about this prayer. It's that Daniel's praying it, and that Daniel is praying it continually using the word "we." Every single confession, he says, "we." "We have, we have, we have not, we have not." It's all "we." Which is remarkable, because if you read Daniel's story, absolutely none of the stuff he mentions in his prayer applies to him. And I mean none of it. Like, he hasn't sinned, he hasn't rebelled, he hasn't done wrong, he hasn't been wicked. In fact, quite the opposite in Daniel's case. Daniel has persistently chosen to be loyal to God in the face of relentless pressure to do otherwise. Relentless pressure that includes, you might just remember, a night in a lion's den. Yet, when he comes before God to pray about his people, he never once says them or they. He says we. Now, this is not how I seem to be wired. I like drawing an us v them sort of line and pointing out clearly that I am not them. And as much as I try, I so often find myself drawing my own lines, my own boundaries. And those become the battle lines, the places where I rage and fight to get my own way. But Daniel offers a completely different model for our society by crossing the boundary line and by refusing the polarization and including himself amongst those who are behaving so differently from him. Rather than being angry at the people, who, by the way, these people's behavior is what's keeping Daniel in captivity. Rather than being angry at them, he prays, not simply for them, but with them, as one of them. Whose side are you on, Daniel? Neither. By aligning himself with those whose behavior contradicted almost everything he stood for, Daniel offers an alternative for how we navigate boundaries. Do we have to rage at people or parties or ideas just because they're different from us? Is it possible that if we say we rather than them, it might change our perspective and maybe just drop our temperature a little bit? Now, let's be honest. 2020 has given us more than enough to be angry about. Racial division, economic threat, climate issues, political misbehaving. But can we really blame 2020 for everything? Like, is it that simple? Is it just because it's 2020? Or has 2020 simply exposed some boundaries that we were way more sensitive to than we realized? So perhaps the question we should be asking is, what is our anger saying about us? Like, if we can only say them and not even imagine a way that we could say we, perhaps the issue isn't them, but me. So is my anger telling me to examine my boundaries? Does it expose my prejudice? Now, rooted in the Christian story is the confession that Jesus is the exact representation of God, the only fully divine person that lived amongst us. Now, if you think about that, there's a model in boundary crossing, that God would become human. Like, this is fully we and not a lot of them. But we often miss how much this move of Jesus to be we, to be with us, is actually then lived out throughout his life as a model for us. Like, Jesus hangs out with the poor and also the rich, the nationalists and the foreigners, the law keepers and the rebels, the religious right and the religious left. And they all, at various points, get mad about this. Like, whose side are you on, Jesus? Neither. But what if Jesus' whole life is a model for how we should navigate our own lives? St. Paul, in 2 Corinthians, he calls us to model Jesus as his ambassadors. But, like, what would that look like for our anger? If our anger is invariably activated by our boundaries, well, think about this. Jesus only ever seemed to become angry because there were boundaries. Like, we quoted Jesus' brother, James, earlier when he said that, you know, well, rage, it just doesn't fix anything. It doesn't make anything right. It doesn't bring justice. Why? Well, I think it's because all rage does is responds to our boundaries being violated by building bigger walls and digging deeper trenches. But if you'll go with me on this, what about an imaginative exercise? What if our anger could actually be helpful? What if we could flip our anger because we know how it works and what it's doing? As James said, it's not that your anger is bad, it just doesn't fix anything. But what if we could rewire our anger? So, anger is about boundaries. Our natural, emotional, and physiological response to boundary violation is that fight or flight threat response. Rarely a positive income, especially if you're on Twitter. But what if we could rewire our process so that we allowed our anger to highlight our boundaries? That instead of pulling the pin and exploding, what if we were able to examine ourselves at that moment? Like, what if my anger is showing me places and opportunities where I need to show grace? What if my anger is showing me places where I need to remove some boundaries? What if my anger is showing me boundaries that I didn't realize I had or wanted, or boundaries that I don't even agree with? Like, this might be painful, but what if we allowed our anger to show us where to cross the line rather than draw it? What if our anger showed us the places where we need to say we and not them? When was the last time you prayed for your enemies? Here's a different question. Have you ever wondered whether it's legitimately acceptable for a Christian to have enemies? Like, Jesus advised us that we should love our enemies. Like, think about that. Like, how does that actually work, Jesus? Like, imagine that at a party. Well, this is my best friend, Dave. Oh, and you must meet Brittany, my most treasured enemy. Of course, actually, Jesus is being really sneaky here. Because if you actually did love your enemy, might that not mean that they're now your friend? See, I think that anger gives us a genuine opportunity to ask why. Why are you angry about this? Like, are you okay that you're angry about this? Maybe a question, is Jesus also angry about this? Or would you just like Jesus more if he was also angry about this? And if you're angry about this, why are you not angry about that? Why is this boundary important to you, but that one isn't? And now, you realize, of course, that the boundary is actually just another word for law, for the rules, the demands, the expectations that we put down, all the time thinking that this will make us right and everyone else wrong. So boundary is just another thing face down by grace. Our anger builds boundaries and walls and laws, and the gospel, this message about Jesus, it comes to us, and as it says in Ephesians chapter 2, it breaks down walls. You see, for Jesus followers, for Christians, I think this is a difficult time. Because we've actually jumped into the polarization. We've taken political sides. We've expressed our outrage, and we've too often failed to offer anything to our society that suggests we're trying to model the way of Jesus. Too often, we've actually added fuel to the fires of division. For many of us, the move from law to grace hasn't actually been one of removing boundaries, but just rather redrawing different boundaries or marginally lowering the walls. But grace calls us to examine the boundaries entirely. Our anger says, only people like me, this side of the line. The grace of Jesus says, there is no line. Grace only says, we. So the good news of Jesus is that it doesn't matter what side of the social or political or racial, gender or economic boundary you find yourself on, because you can't reduce Jesus to a side. That's not what following Jesus is about. So if you're the type of person who wants to follow Jesus, or you're the type of person that says you're following Jesus, and you're finding yourself angry about those people crossing your boundaries, the question the Bible wants to ask us is not, why are you angry, but rather, why do you think that boundary matters so much? Like, we live in a world that increasingly seems to be energized by tapping into our rage, our inner Hulk. It does that by dividing us up and giving us something to be outraged about. But Jesus' imagination for us was for something different, something that erases those boundaries, those touch points of rage, and invites us not to see each other as we and not them. That's what grace does. It invites us to see an alternative to rage. We live in a world that increasingly seems to be energized by tapping into our rage, that inner Hulk. It does that by dividing us up and giving us something to be outraged about. But Jesus' imagination for us was of something different, something that erases those boundaries, those touch points of rage. And it invites us to see each other as we and not them. That's what grace does. It invites us to see an alternative to rage. Because remember, friends, anger doesn't fix things. And that's why, at this moment, more than ever, we need St. Paul's common blessing: grace and peace.